This message comes from Capital One. Your business faces unique challenges and opportunities. That's why Capital One offers a comprehensive suite of financial services backed by the strength of a top 10 commercial bank. Visit CapitalOne.com/commercial. Member FDIC.
Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is a production of MaximumFun.org and is distributed by NPR.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. Elvis Costello has led a rich and varied life. He writes about a lot of it in his new memoir. Like, have you ever had Christmas with Johnny Cash? Elvis Costello did one time, thanks to his producer, Nick Lowe.
I mean, Nick Lowe was the first person who was in a group who I could ask questions of. I'd been around musicians since I was a child, but I had no questions to ask my dad's colleagues. And, of course, then he became my producer when I was first making records. And then a couple of years into that, he married June Carter's daughter, Carlene. And next thing, the in-laws came for Christmas. And the in-laws were Johnny Cash and June Carter. You know, it was like, and we went to the door and he was great. He just introduced himself the way he always did. You know, hello, I'm Johnny Cash. And I couldn't believe he was saying it to me.
They literally sang, drank, and were merry. It's Bullseye. I'll talk with Elvis Costello about his dad, who's a musician too. We'll talk about his dream job if he hadn't gone into music, and also about how he kind of got a reputation for being angry. He says it's something to do with the gap between his front teeth, and also because he's kind of a shy guy.
I was quite shy. I know it sounds a weird thing to say. So I didn't necessarily feel I was naturally born to it. I didn't just want to write songs and stand at the back.
Costello's new memoir is called Unfaithful Music and Disappearing Ink. Then I'll talk to Elizabeth Banks about playing Brian Wilson's future wife, Melinda Ledbetter, in the biopic Love and Mercy. It's a complicated love story. The real Melinda met Brian when he was at a very difficult point of his life.
As a person, me, speaking for myself, getting involved with someone with that much baggage, it probably wouldn't have been for me. You know, personally. And so I had intellectual doubts. And then Melinda reminded me that so much of first meetings are not intellectual. They're not in our minds, right? It's like pheromones fly and somebody speaks to you on a different level. And that she felt he was unlike anyone else she'd ever met.
We'll also talk about directing and producing Pitch Perfect 2. And yes, of course, this being my show, we will talk about the epic kissing scenes between her and Paul Rudd in the movie Wet Hot American Summer. And finally, I'll tell you what I love about something called Dad's Style. That's all coming up on Bullseye. Let's go. It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. Here's my guest, Elvis Costello, singing his song Radio, Radio with the Attractions from 1978. David Lee Roth once said that music critics like Elvis Costello because he looks like them.
Not that again.
But it might be more that it's a good quote. I mean, that is a...
Is it? I don't
that's
know.
That's a solid
you tell me.
Piece of business. I don't know if it's true, but it's fun to
I
say.
I don't know. You tell me. I'm not a writer. I'm a lover, not a fighter.
David Lee Roth once said that music critics like
what
Elvis Costello because he looks like them. But is the next part of this...
Yes.
It might be more because he thinks like them or makes music the way they might like to.
Have you seen David recently?
No.
He looks just like a wizened old writer to me. Yeah, I'm only teasing you. I know, I've heard that one a few times.
Through his career. Through his career, he's taken his favorite I'm going to power through this, Elvis.
Yeah, I know you are. I can sense I'm not going to deflect you.
No, not at all. I'm a professional pseudo journalist. through his career.
I'm proud to hear it.
He's taken his favorite pop sounds, the ones he grew up with, the ones he learned about as a young man, the ones he's come to know in middle age, and he's pushed them through his own vessel. He writes eloquently about this web of influence in his memoir.
Can I stop you a sec? Stop you for a second?
Yes.
Are we talking about David or me? Because this reference to pushing things through my vessel, it frankly sounds quite rude to me. I don't know whether we should be saying this on NPR. I think we may get letters.
There's some things that are legal to say on the radio and some things that aren't. I think I'm allowed to speak metaphorically. If you make it vulgar, we might have to bleep this whole exchange.
I'm almost certain they're going to have to do that. I see them hovering over that big red button there in the control room.
If you're so
And that's
keen...
not a rude reference. I promise you that wasn't intent a double entendre.
Costello writes eloquently about this web of influence in his new memoir, Unfaithful Music and Disappearing Ink. The way that, by the way, you've ruined the entire tone of this introduction. This was a really, thoughtful introduction that I worked very hard on. And now it's just a series of jokes about private parts. And
That's what you know by now from reading this book, that is really my entire aim has been this. I appreciate what you're saying. Of course, the David Lee Roth, we've managed to mention David's name more often than mine. It's amazing. He's getting a lot of free publicity. Maybe he's got a book out as well. I appreciate what you're saying. I'm teasing you. But you're quite right. This book is trying to link up. I wasn't, as you can tell from reading even a few pages, it doesn't begin, I was born, and then I did this, and then I did that, and the laughter and the tears, and my drug hell, and then my conversion to some strange philosophy, and, you know... I tried to connect up emotionally the things that came to me, or the fact that I happened to be born into a family for whom music was both vocation and occupation. Both my parents, my grandfather before my father as well. A life of travel that leads you on adventures and in some cases misadventures, hence the title Unfaithful Music. Memory being somewhat elusive or very vivid and then elusive. Unfortunately, both my father and grandmother, afflicted by dementia in their later years, made me fearful that I would at some point in the future not be able to gather all of these experiences that I've been lucky to have and put them on a page so they could be read by, just say, take two people, my 2 8-year-old boys. I mean, other people want to read it too, that's great. But in some senses, I was thinking about there's some time in the future where I'll wish that I wrote this down, because it may not all join up in quite the same way. That's really what I was trying to say.
Well, I think, I mean, had I gotten to the end of the very beautiful introduction that I wrote.
It was exquisite, by the way.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed your book very much as well.
You
know, one of the musicians that you return to in this book again and again is your dad. And it's how, you know, it's how you start the book, and it's a relationship that is really central to the book. And I wonder, when you were a child, before your dad stopped living with you, what did you think about his music?
Well, I don't think you think a lot of things when you're that age, you know, I form opinions as comparative, is it this or is it that or is it better than this or better than that? My mother tells me I went looking around the back of the television for my dad when I was really a little more than an infant, you know, because I saw him on an early TV show. I saw him, as I describe in the first chapter, from the balcony of a dance hall that was nearly deserted. It's hard to imagine a dance hall opening in the Saturday afternoon for 30 patrons and having a full dance band come out and play tunes for however long they played, you know, but they did in those days. So that was unusual. I would go in the morning when I was off school on holiday and go to radio broadcast theatres in the centre of London and watch musicians who, to my mind, were old men, but of course were men that were 20 years younger than I am now, reading the racing results and smoking cigarettes and waiting for the downbeat. And then a group of young men come in carrying their amplifiers and guitars, and that would be the beat group in one case I described the Hollies, including Graham Nash, coming in from having driven overnight from the north of England so they could sing two songs on a guest slot on a lunchtime radio show. These are sort of, it's a world of music, and pop music doesn't really exist anymore. And this is within my lifetime. Admittedly, as old as I am, it's a surprise to me that things are quite so different. And of course, those images really stayed in my mind. And the transference from the mundane to the magical in the moment of performance was startling to me as a child, but I didn't have anything to compare it to. It was just what my father did for a living. Other dads came home and my dad went to work, you know.
You're listening to Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. I'm talking to the musician Elvis Costello. His new memoir is called Unfaithful Music and Disappearing Ink. I'm going to play a song with your father singing from the mid-1960s. It's called Stop Your Playing Around.
Hey, wow, where'd you find that?
You should be in my arms, loving me, still bad. You were always playing around. Maybe, maybe, maybe when you say, yes, I will, I'll be gone at my fill. So I say, stop your playing around, stop your playing, stop that playing around.
An atypical performance by Rob, I have to say. I should tell you that that was a B-side of one or two, I guess you would call them ska. You can sort of vaguely recognize that as ska. You've got to understand when Bluebeat, as it was called in the early 60s, came in from Jamaica, it was another dance craze, just like the Twist and the Madison before it. And the Jolos Orchestra that my dad played with were a dance band, so the band leader, you know, would say to the arranger, can we adapt these songs for our lineup, which was that of a typical dance band of the 1940s and 50s, you know, with saxophones and trumpets and trombones. He gave my dad the task of writing a few songs in this new style. And hence, there's kind of almost like a West Indian inflection in his voice there, just the same way as people, we learned all our singing from American records. And then latterly, you know, I guess people heard music from all over the world and just copied it. And that was the music. The different thing between England and America is, I think, although there are many people from the Caribbean in America, they all came at once, sort of, as it were, into the culture and really transformed it with bringing music, calypso and you know, ska, and then later reggae. We have that really as our second line of music, you know, to popular music. If you, people of my age anyway, that was what we danced to at parties. And in the early 60s, it's strange to think my dad got to make a record like that, you know, because it was actually trying to keep up with a new trend.
I mean, I'm really just imagining what it must have been like for your dad, who was, you know, by that point a grown adult who'd had a healthy career and was singing in a band that was, you know, like the Glenn Miller band or something like
exactly.
that.
Exactly. Their theme song was actually In the Mood. I mean, they borrowed the theme song from Glenn Miller. They played a lot of the Miller repertoire. One of my favorite recordings of my dad is actually I Know Why and So Do You and At Last, which were recorded for a tribute to Glenn Miller album that was made in the early 60s.
Did he go, like, I'm literally imagining it, and I'm wondering, like, was someone in the band going dum-da-da-dum-da-da-dum, and did he go, like, ha?
I guess so. I know it doesn't seem very likely, but he, you know, they had a sense of humor about these things, and I suppose they weren't always respectful about the numbers. But they also had the groups. They had the young groups of the day on as guests. So the show was attractive to younger listeners because if only they were tuning in to hear their pop favorites. And they would hear these renditions alongside the original groups. And that even sounds strange, I know. But that's how I came to see the Hollies. When I first met Graham Nash in 1979, we were introduced backstage at a gig in Manchester. And I said, we've met before, but you won't recognize me because I had short trousers on, you know. And I had met him at 10. With my dad. And, you know, my dad was very kind. I suppose, as you say, he was a grown-up, you know, he wasn't a kid. But he liked a lot of the music that he was asked to sing. And a lot of the lads in those groups, they were either from Liverpool or from Manchester, they were northern lads. And I suppose he saw some parallel to the journey he'd taken going down to London in the early 50s to make his name in music. And there was some sort of sympathy that might not have been there otherwise. And he used to take my autograph book to the broadcast and come home with signatures. And I have printed them, you know, in there's an electric book of this, you know, one of those ebooks. And I added a gallery of pictures to as an appendix to that edition with, you know, these dedications. And they're poignant to read them now because some of them are people like Tom Jones, you know, that are well known to this day. Others, Freddie Garrity of Freddie and the Dreamers, who not such a household name, you know.
Was your father a better singer than you are?
Technically, yes. I mean, the record you played didn't really show his voice to best effect, but if you heard him singing At Last, you would definitely say that.
Were you sort of aware of that when you were a kid?
I mean, I never thought about it because I was never going to be a musician when I was a kid. I wanted to be a coal man. I mean, you know what I mean? A coal man, a man that delivers coal, not a miner. I wanted to be a coal man.
Why did you want to?
Because I like getting dirty and I like the smell of it. Then the nuns tried to make me into a priest, and that didn't work out. So I was stuck with being in rock and roll.
You write in the book that you think that people took you as angry just because of the gap in your front teeth.
That's certainly true. I've had lots of altercations with people of authority. Teachers, border guards, policemen, because if you can hear it now, I can hear it on the microphone, that the air that's expelled between the gap in somebody's teeth who's born like I was and didn't get their teeth straightened, it causes this sort of thing. It could be a lisp, which could make you sound very gentle, or if you express things emphatically, it makes you sound as if it's slightly more exaggerated than perhaps you sometimes mean. And I also have a loud voice, which means that people jump out of their skin, you know, and I'm obviously making a joke. I mean, hey, look at Jane Birkin, you know, she was just the most beguiling person when you saw pictures of her as a young woman, and even today she's extraordinary, and she has that. Ray Davis has it. Jerry Lewis has it. What links us all together is our teeth.
Did you feel like you belonged to like a scene or a group or a cohort? Like in the beginning, did you think, oh, I can be a punk rocker and that's what
no.
I'll be, or I can be a...
Absolutely not, no. I actually don't think anybody thought like that. I think that was just something journalists made up because it was a way to kind of explain a phenomenon or make it seem like a phenomenon. And maybe some of the scene makers and managers wanted to have it seen like that. There was like a manifesto that you had to live up to. Those guys were, there's always that thing where, you know, managers will say something in a performance who might be more naive and have a talent that isn't quite formed or focused. So they say, well, you know, do this gimmicky thing and that will make them make you stand out. Well, in my case, it was a sort of absurd name. Other people, it was like, spout this stuff off and then they'll pay attention to you. And it gives you that moment of, you know, in the spotlight, and then it's what you do with it. But I don't think anybody was thinking, yeah, I've got to be a punk, except like really untalented people. You know, the people that wanted to be that usually weren't it ever, you know. I mean, like I said, in one memory of seeing Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young play in 74, that day I felt when I heard Neil Young play Don't Be Denied, that had all the attitude of punk rock. But obviously musically it doesn't sound anything like what people think of as punk. And, you know, you can hear records from the 1950s that just have the swagger that you associate with it. You can hear records from 1966 made in garage bands, you know, that have it. So all of these labels, they were just matters of convenience. Like, you know, over the history of recorded music, they've just used names to somewhat keep people down, keep them in boxes, you know, and this is classy music, and we'll just think about when they recorded some of the greatest artists who've ever walked the earth, and they were obliged to be on things that were called race records, you know. I mean, that's pretty extraordinary, but it's, you know, it's in living memory, you know.
One of the people that you met when you were still very young, relatively new to the music industry, was Johnny Cash, right?
Yeah, well, that was a complete coincidence. You know, I know I would have no way to have met him in the circumstance, you know, could have never imagined. I mean, Nick Lowe was the first person who was in a group who I could ask questions of. I'd been around musicians since I was a child, but I had no questions to ask my dad's colleagues. I didn't ask my dad a lot of questions about music. He also didn't impose on me the learning of any music theory. although his father had been a classically trained or military trained musician. So I had questions for Nick Lowe. They were about songwriting. I can't even remember what they were now, you know. And, of course, then he became my producer when I was first making records. And then a couple of years into that, he married June Carter's daughter, Carlene. And next thing, the in-laws came for Christmas. And the in-laws were Johnny Cash and June Carter, you know. It was like, and we were invited round for a recording session on the day after Christmas. I mean, it sounds absolutely fantastic, but it really happened, you know. And, of course, it was to be in a confined space of a you know, domestic setting in England with Johnny Cash was a bit unusual, you know.
It's not exactly where you imagine.
He was so unbelievably like himself. It was, you know, it was like...
You don't really imagine Johnny Cash like walking through a Victorian Christmas card, you know?
Well, it was, yeah, a little bit like that. You know, Christmas time and it's London. I mean, you know, obviously the American idea of it is lots of urchins, you know, bare feet. And, you know, we're all huddling together around a brazier.
You were a chimney sweep at the time, right?
I was. It was in my years as a chimney sweep. And I said, oh, God bless you, Mr. Cash. May I have a penny to pay for a roast goose? It wasn't, you know, it's like Dick Van Dyke, you know, Mary Poppins. You know, we went to the door and he was great. He just introduced himself the way he always did. You know, hello, I'm Johnny Cash. I couldn't believe he was saying it to me. And then, you know, there was there was certainly some drinking going on with, I described in the book, Johnny relating this night later on in a tribute to George Jones, because the song we recorded was a song that George had written, a rare composition. And Johnny reciting it was perhaps the best thing of all, because, you know, he sort of said, well, I was with Elvis Costello and Nick Lowe, and they were drinking a little bit, and, you know, and apparently we toasted to how great George was. And I mean, this was later in the evening, perhaps after we had recorded this duet, which was vocally fairly ill-advised on my part, I have to say. You know, it was to try and get in the ring with John, but they were really, really great people, him and June, and then had us up to their house when I dragged the attractions to Nashville to record country songs, and you know, treated us like friends of the family, which was again very head spinning. And each time our paths crossed, they were always even and the same in that way. And of course, he ended up, there was this strange period in 1986 where I was a Columbia Records recording artist and he wasn't. You know, it was so unbelievable to me that they let him go. They let Miles Davis go the same year. I thought, you know, this is really backwards. And he took up a song of mine that was on his first record, on his next recording on Mercury. And then I wrote him a song called Hidden Shame that he recorded on the second record. And, you know, I sent another song to him when he started recording again in the American recordings. It never got into the pile, but he knew I was thinking of him, you know. And John Carter Cash, his son, recently sent me a handwritten manuscript that in Johnny's handwriting of my song. And that's how he learned songs. He would write them out longhand to look at the words. And that was pretty great to receive that, you know. That's one of my, I have it in a frame.
I'll finish my conversation with Elvis Costello after a break and talk to Elizabeth Banks. She's one of the stars of the film Love and Mercy, and she directed one of this year's biggest hits, Pitch Perfect 2. It's Bullseye. From MaximumFun.org and NPR.
Thanks for listening to Bullseye. For music, games, puzzles, and trivia of all sorts right now, check out Ask Me Another. Play along with a Seinfeld-themed version of Taboo, games of mysterious phenomena, and see what you know about some of the lesser-known puppets on Sesame Street. Ask Me Another is like Trivia Night, but a lot funnier. Play along now at npr.org/podcasts. That's npr.org/podcasts and on the NPR One app.
Jesse Thorne here. I'm taking Bullseye on the road in November. It's our world tour of several American cities. Get your tickets now while you can. They're going fast. Come see me and William H. Macy and Barney Frank and Tavi Gevinson, John Hodgman, the director of the Mutter Museum, who's going to do medical experiments on me, apparently. Ray Suarez, Dan Deacon, so many more. Music, comedy, and interviews at every tour stop. Go to bullseyetour.com to get your tickets. You will not want to miss this. If you're in Philadelphia, Boston, New York City, Washington, D.C., or our own great city of Los Angeles, California. BullseyeTour.com to get tickets. I'm Jesse Thorne. This is Bullseye. My guest is the musician and now memoirist Elvis Costello. His new book is Unfaithful Music and Disappearing Ink. I want to play a song that you wrote for one of my favorite singers of all time, Solomon Burke, who recorded an album in the early 2000s. It was sort of a comeback album for him, although he had done very well on the road for decades and decades. Mm. And it's called The Judgment. Let's take a listen. When you're writing a song for somebody whose style, whose instrument is as distinctive as somebody like Solomon Burke or Johnny Cash, are you thinking of it the way, say, a comedy writer might think about, you know, writing a joke for David Letterman or Roseanne Barr, thinking about trying to capture something about their particular voice?
It's sort of different with music, I would think. At least for me, it is. I had dreams of people singing songs that came true. I had a dream of Dusty Springfield singing my song. I had a dream of Chet Baker singing my song. A dream of Roy Orbison. Dream of Johnny Cash. Even though I knew John a little bit, you know, I still didn't sort of really think he would pick up my song. Not the first time, anyway. With Solomon, it was a little bit different because I'd had the experience of trying to write for some people and not got the measure of them right. I was trying to put too much into a song or didn't quite get the measurement right. And even with this one, there were a couple of tricks to this song musically that interrupted Solomon's flow. And Joe Henry, who produced this record, who's a friend of mine who also produced The River in Reverse and worked with Alain Toussaint, he had me stand in the booth with Solomon. Because I was at the recording session, and Solomon, you know, was such a big personality, but in many ways he was like, there was something really wonderful about the way he you know, invited you in, and he told me to sing it for him, because there was this timing of this one line, he just kept, every time he'd get rolling with it, he'd come in the wrong place, and you know, I got to learn this, so you sing it. Can you imagine that, having to stand in front of Solomon Burke and sing the song, you know? I could sort of sing it in my head, you know, and then I did, and then of course then he learned it, and he could hear what it was. Once he could watch me do it, he got what the rhythm of it was, and then he sang it great, you know. And I mean, Nick Lowell will tell the same story about staying up all night to imagine writing The Beast in Me for Johnny Cash, and then sort of the next day, you know, June, having heard about it, getting Nick to play it to Johnny. And so when it came out, of course, it came out in this feeble little voice that wasn't like this big voice. It was like, "You're the beast in me." You know, it was like, because the dream we have of the singer is often, you know, we can't animate like that, you know?
I'm Jesse Thorne. This is Bullseye. My guest is the musician and now memoirist Elvis Costello. Here's a little bit of Allison from 1977's My Aim Is True. Like those other stick of Valentine's, 'cause I don't know if you are loving somebody, I only know it isn't mine. Who in your life knows you by your birth name, Declan McManus?
my mother, a handful of friends, a few people that knew me, you know, before I ever got into this world, you know, of music and adopted other names, you know.
When you adopted the name, it was the name that was given to you by your manager, right?
The second name was as a family name. Costello is, more correctly said, Costello. It's an Irish name. It's my great-grandmother, Elizabeth Costello. I'd adopted that because it was easier to say and shorter to write down. And I'd use my initials for a while, DP, because my dad used to address me that way, which is an Irish convention too. And then they handed me that, and it was like a dare. And, you know, my father had recorded under other aliases in the 1960s. He'd recorded cover records for cash money, you know, early in the morning sessions that were put out on cheap cover records where you get four titles from the Hit Parade on an EP, on an extended play vinyl record. And he went on, sometimes he'd be three or four aliases on one release. You know, he'd be Hal Prince and the Layabouts, or the Foresters singing Blowing in the Wind, or Frank Bacon and the Baconeers. So you can appreciate that being Elvis Costello really was just like second nature to me.
When you go into like a Starbucks or whatever, do you tell them your name is Elvis or Declan?
I try to avoid doing that anyway. I mean, I usually don't tell them anything.
Was there ever a point where it stopped feeling strange to be addressed by a made-up name?
Well, nobody ever did call me that by that name anyway. Oddly enough, the thing of being called by my initials, which I know from childhood, is sort of the way everybody's always addressed me in my camp, you know, as it were, in my gang, whether it was the band or the management. It was always EC, so that was easier, you know, shorter. And I don't ever recall that many people ever calling me by Elvis. You know?
Well, I'm really grateful to you for taking the time to be on Bullseye. Thank you so much for talking.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Your most thoughtful questions. Thank you.
Elvis Costello. His new memoir is called Unfaithful Music and Disappearing Ink. If you enjoyed my talk with him, you can find a longer cut of this on our podcast, which is at npr.org/podcasts in iTunes or whatever software you use to listen to podcasts. It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. I read someone say that Elizabeth Banks always has the fire in her eyes. It's one of her greatest gifts as an actress, and from what I can tell, it comes from something real. Last year, when the director dropped out of a film she was producing, Banks didn't hesitate. She said she'd direct. Her first feature film as a director, Pitch Perfect 2, became one of the biggest comedy hits of all time. That fire has led her to more than 70 film roles, from the insane and hilarious Wet Hot American Summer to Seabiscuit, The Hunger Games, and the recent Brian Wilson biopic Love and Mercy. In that film, Banks plays a car saleswoman who meets a middle-aged Wilson by chance, falls in love, and eventually tears him away from a psychiatrist who's controlling his life. Here's her meeting with Wilson in the film, who's played in this part of the movie by John Cusack. They're sitting together inside of a new Cadillac, and the conversation sort of takes an unexpected turn. You'll hear Wilson's bodyguard tapping on the window.
Brian.
Melinda.
Hi.
Come on, Brian.
I want this car.
The Fleetwood.
No. Yeah, but I want this car, okay? I want this car, this one we're sitting in.
Oh. See, the floor model is...
Yes. It's your favorite, right?
You want...
It's special. You understand? Can I have it?
Sure.
Okay.
Yes.
Hey.
Hey.
What's happening, guys?
Hi, Gene.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm Dr. Eugene Landy. How are you? I'm Brian's brother from another mother. What's up?
I want the blue fleet with Gene.
Really?
Yeah.
You sure you don't want a Maserati? No offense.
Van Dagen.
No. That one.
Really?
It's her favorite.
Okay. Well, I'm going to expect a deal here. You know, something worth our while. Do you know who this man is? Brian Wilson. Brian Wilson of the Beach Boys.
Ah. You didn't mention that.
Well, because that stuff doesn't matter. That's ego stuff, you know?
Are you kidding me? I love your music. I grew up on it. So thank you.
That makes me feel really good, Melinda Ledbetter.
Elizabeth Banks, welcome to Bullseye. It's great to have you on the show.
Thank you.
In a movie like this, you know, you've got two great actors who are playing Brian Wilson. And Brian Wilson has been a famous person since like 1961 or something. Mm-hmm. So they have some responsibility to represent this thing that we know and understand. You're playing a character who was also a producer on the film in real life. You have kind of part of the responsibility of representing someone's real life, but you don't get the extra points for doing an impression of that person, which is not to take anything away from either Dana or Cusack's performance, both of which are amazing. And you also are so central in the story of his life. Like, you, your character is the turning point.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a lot to place on you as an actress. Like, your role in telling the story is huge.
Well, geez, when you put it that way, maybe I never would have done it. It was such a seductive idea, the notion of doing a Brian Wilson biopic in two different time periods with two different actors about a man whose life is very fragmented and who is, as a person, suffers from mental illness. You know, it's interesting because Brian became a recluse in his life. You know, no one, he sort of disappeared. He was like, no one knew where he went, you know, the lead singer and the architect of the Beach Boys sort of disappeared. So I think all of us felt a little relief, as you say, that like no one really knew what he looked like then or what was happening or, you know, who he was hanging out with. Even though, of course, we feel a great responsibility to Brian, who's alive, and his wife, Melinda, who I play, who's alive and wonderful and a great friend to me now. And but also a responsibility to the legacy of the Beach Boys, because whatever we did, this movie became a part of that legacy because it was blessed by Brian and his family. And we got invited into that. And that was the craziest part of the whole thing, just sort of meeting them and hearing the stories and feeling like you were with rock royalty the whole time.
I think that your character in this film could very easily have been woman who comes into Brian Wilson's life, falls in love with him, and crusades on his behalf.
That's right. The savior.
Right. And that seems to have been sort of, you know, one of the tricks that the film pulls off is not making the story that simple. That part of this story is about your character trying to figure out what it's okay to do in this crazy world that you could never, like, how could you understand it? It's insane. You know what I mean?
I had a lot of conversations with Melinda about what was going on when they first met in her mind and what she knew and when she knew it. And because, look, I have, as a person, me, speaking for myself, getting involved with someone with that much baggage, it probably wouldn't have been for me, you know, personally. And so I had intellectual doubts. And then Melinda reminded me that so much of first meetings are not intellectual. They're not in our minds, right? It's like pheromones fly and somebody speaks to you on a different level. And that she felt he was unlike anyone else she'd ever met. And what's also great is that Cusack and I, you know, we're not 22 and they were older when they met. They'd been around so many blocks and they'd had a lot of people in their lives. And so to just come to someone at that point and have it's not so much a second chance, but like a final first chance at something deep and real with someone really meant something to both of them at that time in their lives.
Were there any specific things that you heard from her that helped you understand this kind of weird circumstance, besides just the magic of meeting someone at first? Because part of the story is about moving further away as much as it's about coming closer.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, she despised Eugene Landy. and rightfully so.
He was the doctor who was
manipulating and
in care of Wilson.
Yes.
And
yes. He was he was a quack doctor. I don't, I mean, He's passed on now, but by all accounts was essentially a fraud and was using Brian. And, you know, the interesting thing about it is if you talk to Brian, who's the loveliest man, he does not hold any grudges. And he really does say there was good and bad. You know, in other words, he was not crazy about Eugene's care for him. I do believe Dr. Landy got him out of bed and got him healthier and eating and sort of out in the world again. You know, you played the scene at the top of the movie when they went and bought a car, and that's what Eugene was doing. Like, let's go out and spend your money and buy things and put you back into the world and see how you do. But then he was also very controlling of anything that Brian was doing. And Melinda disliked him immensely immediately and really felt that he did not have Brian's best interests at heart. And when we're unfolding a film, you don't want Paul Giamatti, who plays Eugene Landy in the movie, to walk on to the scene just immediately. We're like, the whole audience go, well, that guy's a bad guy.
Something that I was thinking as I was watching Love and Mercy is that you have so often played kind of driven, directed characters. And, like on 30 Rock, you know, you're playing against Alec Baldwin, who's obviously the paragon of driven and directed performers, right? He's literally the guy from that scene in Glengarry Glen Ross, right?
Yeah.
And this is a character that is so different from that. I mean, obviously she has some of that sort of strength. You as an actor can't expect that what you're going to do is push the other performer in the scene. They're going to push back, mm-hmm. and you're going to build something that way because of who Brian Wilson was.
That's right. Melinda was vulnerable, and she was, you know, in her late 30s when she met Brian. I mean, kids were sort of, for her, out of the question. So she was a little bit broken, too. And I brought up her distrust and dislike of Eugene because one of the pivots that the character, for me, that I felt I needed to make as the character in the movie and portraying all of this was being vulnerable with Brian and being open to loving him and him loving me and having this relationship with him, but then also having the drive to pull him out of that, what he was stuck in, essentially, so that we could be together. There just was this moment where I thought, this character needs to be driven not just by her love for Brian, but truly by wanting to win over Landy. And that became a sort of simpler goal. Just beat Landy.
But that's still colored by, there are a lot of moments in the film where your character is asking, like, do I belong here? Like, is this the place I should be? Should I just
walk away?
Yeah,
absolutely. No, and there were many moments. You know, the other thing about this, the true story is that it played out over a longer period of time because Landy really did keep Brian from Melinda. You know, they went to Hawaii for long periods of time. And so she saw him so intermittently for a while there. But always, every time they got back together, did feel this deep connection and did want to be together. And I think she felt he wanted help. He would say it, but then back off of it. And it was, you know, there's a great scene in the film actually where he says, I need you to leave, but I don't want you to leave me. And that really encompassed the turmoil of what they went through for a long time.
I'll finish my conversation with Elizabeth Banks after a break. It's Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and NPR.
Thanks for listening to Bullseye. For music, games, puzzles, and trivia of all sorts right now, check out Ask Me Another. Play along with a Seinfeld-themed version of Taboo, Games of Mysterious Phenomena, and see what you know about some of the lesser-known puppets on Sesame Street. Ask Me Another is like Trivia Night, but a lot funnier. Play along now at npr.org/podcasts. That's npr.org/podcasts and on the NPR One app.
Hello, I'm Taku, the Elven Magician.
Merle Highchurch here, the master of clerical magic.
I'm Magnus Burnside, the fighter.
Did you guys like that?
Did you, the listener, like that? You were just swept up in a world of high fantasy and magic where anything can happen and anything is possible.
Hi, I'm Griffin McElroy, Dungeon Master for The Adventure Zone, a new podcast on Maximum Fun,
in which magic and mystery intertwine for a very erotically charged role-playing experience.
You can catch it every other Thursday here on MaximumFun.org or iTunes. It's for Dungeons & Dragons, but with family.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. I'm talking to the actor and director Elizabeth Banks, who stars in Love and Mercy, a biopic about Brian Wilson from the Beach Boys. It's out now on VOD and DVD. Banks has been in a bunch of movies and TV shows, including 30 Rock, Wet Hot American Summer, and The Hunger Games. She also directed Pitch Perfect 2. How'd you get this part?
Oh, geez, I don't know. I didn't really connect to the character until I met Melinda, and then I really felt like compelled to do it. I just thought felt so connected to the actual Melinda that I thought if anyone else does this, I'll be so angry.
What weren't you sure about before that?
It's a big bold idea. This movie is very bold. You know, I've been in some biopics before and played some real people a few times. And, you know, there's always this big responsibility. And we're always sort of, as artists, trying to figure out a way to tell. It's very hard to tell someone's whole life, you know, in 2 hours. And as you said at the beginning, so how do you distill someone's life into a compelling movie and really say something? And this is about one of the great artists, and we need to make a piece of art about him. And it was very daunting. A great challenge, which is ultimately why I wanted to be a part of it. But I definitely was seduced by the ideas, but I thought it would be very difficult to pull off two time periods. You know, we deal with Brian's life in the 60s and then pick it up in the 80s. Two actors playing him. It just seemed a little insane, which is exactly why it works. Because our subject matter was a little touched himself, and great. And I was frustrated on his behalf, even just reading, you know, then going in and reading some of the biographies and Landy's writings, which are madness, and knowing that someone who had been left by their family, shamed, who was a great artist inside and who couldn't figure out, who wasn't being allowed to sort of fly free as an artist, that really touched me. The notion of just being someone who's not living their full potential, that drives me crazy for anybody, whether you're a 9-year-old or, you know, or Caitlyn Jenner. You know, like, everybody should have the right to fly free.
You've had an extraordinarily successful acting career over the last 20 years or so.
Yeah.
You've been in a whole pile of things, including a whole pile of great things. You have infrequently been the star of films, and you're an actress, which means two things. One is the kind of simple actor's dilemma, which is that your job is collaborative and interpretive. And the other is that because of basically because of the sexism of the entertainment industry, it's a lot less common for an actress to get something really good to do than an actor. And I wonder if you have ever felt like you had to fight to make your real voice heard.
Sure.
Elizabeth, let's talk about examples. Give me an example.
Oh, I mean, not. You know, being frustrated by the work has definitely fueled me. You know, feeling that I was sort of a bit of a wasted talent. I don't know. It's hard to talk about, you know, because then you have to sort of say, well, I think I'm good. And that's hard to say because maybe not everybody agrees.
But you're good enough at saying that I think I'm good to have decided that you should direct a movie that, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars movie.
Yeah, well, I knew I could do. I mean, I think that's what it is you sort of, you know, jobs come across your desk all the time that you go, well, I know how to do this. I will do. I know what to do. I know exactly how to do that. You know, this is my job. It's the only job I've ever had, is working in this entertainment industry. And, you know, I came into it. I remember in the beginning, it was like, well, you're pretty and funny, so you'll be fine. And then I was all right. I was kind of fine. I work consistently, definitely because I'm pretty and funny. And I remember being on a set at a certain point, and someone kept coming up to me like, you look great. You look so great. And I was like, am I compelling you? All right, great. I'm glad I look good. What else?
Did you ever think when you were, you know, when you are still relatively starting out, you know, the first 5-10 years of your life, you ever have a meeting with an agent or manager or something like that where you said, we got to make sure that I'm this kind of thing so that people can understand what I am and I can work? We got a brand?
No, I didn't actually. I had some really great, interesting meetings. I did have a meeting with someone who didn't think I had big enough boobs didn't say outright get a job, but was basically like, maybe get a boob job. I mean, I left the meeting thinking like, I'm pretty sure he just thinks he won't represent me unless I get a boob job.
Wait, it was just like a first. This was like a first meeting.
Yeah, it was a first meeting. It was an early meeting with an agent. Yep. And then I had an agent who straight up said to me, if you were a guy, I would represent you, but representing women is not worth the money. I won't make any money if I represent you. That was awesome. So I have had some really great meetings with people who I don't work with, luckily.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. I'm talking to the actor Elizabeth Banks, who stars in the Brian Wilson biopic Love and Mercy alongside John Cusack. I have a lot of friends in the comedy industry, a lot of whom are women. And I think irrespective of their feelings about like collegiate a cappella or like competition films or like, you know, like young adult pop entertainment films, like one of the things that they were so excited about when Pitch Perfect came out was like, hey, this is a fun movie about women. And sure, it has some of the things that people associate with fun movies about women. You know, it's like relationship driven, although it's more of a sisterly relationship driven mm-hmm. than it is romantically relationship driven. But like, they're just like, oh, yeah. And it's full of super funny jokes.
Yeah.
Like, finally, women get to have just a movie full of super funny jokes.
Really funny jokes. That's it.
That must have been really fun. Like when you made this movie, I'm sure when you were producing the first film, you imagined, you know, I can't think that what your plan was to have happen what happened,
no.
Which is that it became a huge hit. Like I think you were probably hoping, oh, good, great. Like maybe this movie will make $40 million and have a nice long tail on DVD or whatever.
But
it must have been awesome when just people were like, oh, thanks for making that movie I've been wanting to watch.
Yeah. Well, it also, look, we were sort of told, like, this is going to be a movie for teenage girls, which was great. And they allowed us to walk the line jokes-wise and make a PG-13, which was great, so that we could, you know, actually make funny, really funny jokes. And be kind of sexy and, you know, college.
And have sophisticated jokes, not just dirty jokes.
That's right.
That their jokes are cleverer than they need to be for a 16-year-old.
That's right.
No offense to 16-year-olds.
No. Well, really what we wanted to make a movie that older kids thought was cool because cool flows down. So, like, if something's cool to a 20-year-old, then the 16-year-old and the 12-year-old and the 9-year-old, they're all on board because the 20-year-old thought it was cool. So cool always flows down. We just had so much fun. Like we looked for what we thought would be really fun. And the singing, I think, brings a real joy to the film, which is contagious. And people love singing and dancing. Everybody has a little bit of a rock star inside of them or that aspiration. And we all sing in the shower and in the car. And anybody who says they don't is lacking in joy.
Let's hear a clip from Pitch Perfect 2. So the Bellas, which is the collegiate a cappella team at the center of the presumably soon to be Pitch Perfect trilogy, are at this singing competition. They've completely lost their way. You'll be surprised to hear they had obstacles in their path.
Yeah,
they're at this singing competition about halfway in, and they're like trying to pull out all the stops to get their mojo back.
Oh, yeah.
And so you will hear that, and then you will also hear Elizabeth Banks, my guest, and John Michael Higgins as the competition judges. By the way, thank you for including the world of podcasting in your film. / a cappella podcasters.
That's right.
Right, this is some exciting stuff.
So sassy.
I dream of this is real love, but you know what they say about me. That girl is a problem. Girl is a problem. Girl is a problem. Problem.
Wow, a lot going on up there.
I think this sounds good. Honestly, my senses are overwhelmed here, John.
You might want to tone down the theatrics. Let's hope there are no props.
Dream girl. Oh, they brought the props out, John.
And they're the props.
This is more of a circus act than an a cappella performance.
Gail, it's as if the Barton Bellas just don't know who they are anymore.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. I'm talking to the actor and director Elizabeth Banks, who stars in Love and Mercy, a biopic about Brian Wilson from the Beach Boys. It's out now on VOD and DVD. I feel like I could never sit down with Elizabeth Banks for this long and completely leave out Wet Hot American Summer.
Oh, thank you.
Which is a film that came out now 15-ish years ago. And recently, multi-part Netflix limited series,
mm-hmm.
Which is,
sublime.
It's the best. It's totally the best. Your character is in the film is sort of the hot chick,
mm-hmm.
and you have a romance with the sort of on again, off again romance with the hot guy who's played by Paul Rudd. And, you know, like any teen film, and I should say that, like, most of the people in the movie were well into their 20s, some in their 30s, playing
Correct.
These teenagers.
Playing, yeah, 15.
And
16.
Now are playing them in their 40s.
Mm-hmm. We're playing 3 months younger.
Yeah.
In the Netflix series.
But, like any teen film, you know, there's some making out. And then just you and Paul Rudd just opening your mouths as far as they will go and just putting them on each other's faces.
Yeah, pretty much like dislodge your jaw.
Like the snake in The Little Prince.
Uh-huh.
Eating an elephant.
Yeah. Yeah, it was like I don't really remember, but it was like we were definitely going to just like eat each other's faces. Like eating was more appropriate. Like how could I get his entire head in my mouth?
I feel like if I had the chance to make out with Paul Rudd, and I say this as a, you know, I've committed the last 34 years of my life to heterosexuality.
Sure.
I'd hate to waste it, you know, putting my teeth on his ear, you know what I mean? Like, that guy's a dreamboat.
That was really fun. It almost felt more intimate to be like, and then my tongue was in your nostril, or, you know, and then like our teeth were banging. Yeah, it's more a little slightly. I went there. It's a little more hardcore, actually.
Elizabeth Banks, I'm sure grateful you came in here. It was really great to get to talk to you. Thank you very much.
Oh, thanks.
Elizabeth Banks. She stars alongside John Cusack in the Brian Wilson biopic Love and Mercy, which is available now on Blu-ray, DVD, and digital HD. She's also in the Hunger Games films, and she'll direct a follow-up to the smash hit Pitch Perfect 2 next year. Every week, we like to close the show with a recommendation from me, your host. It's The Outshot. There are a lot of great Japanese menswear magazines. Men's X is one of them. Go Out is a good one. There's Popeye. That's the magazine for city boys. It says that right on the cover. Lightning is a nice one, mostly vintage stuff in there. There's one called Oily Boy, which I swear to God I'm not making up. But if you live in the States, you can't just get these magazines at the mall. unless it's a Japanese mall. Actually, that's where I get them, a Japanese mall in San Francisco. In a huge Japanese bookstore called Kinokuniya. There's one in L.A. and one in New York, too. So once I'm done eating one of those waffles that's shaped like a fish with the bean paste inside, I head for the bookstore and I go straight for a magazine called Free and Easy. It's kind of like American style taken deeper than deep. I think in a way it takes an obsessive outsider's eye to really get it. Anyway, Free and Easy does theme issues. There's no hot chicks. There's no gadget reviews. Just some real in-depth stuff about, for example, Ivy League style or classic outdoor wear or, and this one is my favorite by a mile, something they call dad's style. Why do I love dad's style? Well, I'll start with this. It's not because I can read Japanese, because I cannot. It's just that I'm a dad. Like, I don't just have kids. I do have kids. But I'm also a grown man. I'm not the dudes in American fashion magazines, and honestly, I've never really aspired to be one of them. Look, I wish LeBron James the best, but I don't really look up to him. I don't want to have a life that peaks at 26 or 27. I want to get better the more I do this. Who are my dad role models supposed to be? Who are the family men on TV I'm supposed to admire? The overweight dolts on CBS sitcoms? The jerks in beer commercials? Anyway, back to dad style. What's wonderful about dad style is that it's a celebration of a mature masculinity. Not mature as a euphemism for elderly, just, you know, being a dang grown-up. It's about the pleasure of getting better with time. The editor of Free and Easy is named Minoru Onozato, and this is how he described dad's style. And his English isn't perfect, but it's better than your Japanese. Dad's style means the man who has his own style, who spends his days immersed in his interests with full intellectual curiosity. He should also do his best for his professional career. This is the style we idealize. One of the greatest pleasures of living a considered life, aesthetically speaking, is that taste develops. It grows and deepens and ripens with experience. In other words, if you give some time to beauty, it repays you with interest. And that's what you get from having been around the block. Almost anything we enjoy comes from some kind of connoisseurship. Great wine or a great record or a great sentence. That feeling of getting it right and appreciating what's right about it, those are grown-up pleasures. Knowing the world, knowing yourself. That's not for kids. That is for dads. And that is why I love dad's style. Even if I can't read Japanese. At least there's a lot of pictures. That's my outshot. Tell them about it. Tell them about your daddy. My daddy was a bad man down. What you say? What's about? Yeah. My daddy was a bad man down. We've come to the end of another episode of Bullseye. The show is produced by Speaking Into Microphones. Our producer is Julia Smith. Production fellow at Maximum Fun is Abarian Exparello. Senior producer is Colin Anderson. All our interstitial music is provided by Dan Wally. Thanks to the Go team and their label Memphis Industries for our theme music. Thanks this week to Neil Rauch at NPR New York for engineering help. If you'd like to hear any of our past shows, they're all free. Just go to MaximumFun.org. And if you want to hear about more cool culture stuff, you can check out our sister show, Pop Rocket. It's a roundtable discussion of everything great in popular culture, hosted by comedian Guy Branum. You can find it wherever you get your podcasts. Pop Rocket. I guess that's about it. Just remember, all great radio hosts have a signature sign-off.
Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is a production of MaximumFun.org and is distributed by NPR.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Charles Schwab with their original podcast, Choiceology. Choiceology is a show about the psychology and economics behind people's decisions. Download the latest episode and subscribe at schwab.com/podcast.
Support for NPR and the following message come from IXL Online. Is your child asking questions on their homework you don't feel equipped to answer? IXL Learning uses advanced algorithms to give the right help to each kid, no matter the age or personality. One subscription gets you everything. One site for all the kids in your home, pre-K to 12th grade. Make an impact on your child's learning. Get IXL now. And NPR listeners can get an exclusive 20% off IXL membership when they sign up today at IXL.com/NPR.
In this country, some truths aren't self-evident. In NPR's Black Stories, Black Truths, a collection of stories as wide-ranging and real as the people who tell them, we celebrate the Black experience for all its soul and richness. Search NPR Black Stories, Black Truths wherever you get podcasts.